Welcome to On Par with Maury Povich. Today, we're going to step into the world of basketball, but you know, it's not in the way you'd expect. We're going to be talking to a man who has trained some of the greatest athletes to ever wear an NBA jersey. Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, Steph Curry, Chris Paul, you name it, he might have trained them. But what if I told you that he was able to gain the trust of the world's most elite athletes without ever playing big-time basketball, even in college? He never played beyond high school. He's a former lawyer with an unstoppable passion for the game, and he left his salary-paying firm to rewrite the rule book on exactly how athletes should be trained. So let's welcome the man that Kevin Durant has said is truly one of a kind, a man who lives, breathes, bleeds basketball, Idan Ravine.
Oh, thank you Welcome. For having me, Maury. Appreciate it.
So I'm not wrong when I mentioned all those names.
No, and I always have to pinch myself when I hear that because it's been an unexpected journey for sure.
Let's go back because I want to hear about you. I want to find out about you because that's the people who are watching this podcast want to know, who is this guy? And by the way, I'm sure there are coaches who said, you're going to train with this guy who never played college basketball? Are you crazy?
Yeah, absolutely. So when people ask me, like, how did this all start, I'd say the five-second answer is that I found something I love to do, and I was stubborn enough to believe I could do it. The long answer was that I grew up an immigrant family. Both my parents teach Jewish education, Holocaust.
I went to Jewish schools,
yes. I studied five classes a day were Hebrew language classes, religion classes. The other five were English subject classes. And then a couple times a week we'd have gym.
Were your parents Orthodox?
Yes.
Or were they conservative?
So my father's side of the family is those Hasidic Jews you see in Brooklyn. Ah. So very religious.
And the hats.
Correct. And then my mother, less so, but still very observant. And so the idea of basketball to them sounded so foreign. I mean,
right.
You know, my parents can quote Deuteronomy and Genesis, but they're not telling you how to run a 40-yard dash, right? But there was something about basketball that I fell in love with very quickly. I think it was because it didn't require my parents to spend any money they didn't have, and it was something I could do on my own.
And there's this story about you messing around with deflated basketballs?
Yeah, because my parents never bought me a basketball. They thought it was expensive. So what I would do is I would find a basketball and let it sit in the sun. And then the sun, it would inflate. And that's the basketballs I would use to teach myself.
It would actually inflate?
Correct.
That's enough where you could dribble it?
Correct, yes. But if you leave it in the sun long enough, right? And so that's was my secret to how I would get a basketball. I would find an old one and I would let it sit in the sun.
So you were a very good player with this Jewish day school.
Yes, I was a very, very talented player, very talented athlete. I could do everything. Completely self-taught, right? I literally would, I always call it BI or BCP, before internet, before cell phone,
right?
Where I literally would just open up a Sports Illustrated article and look at someone's form or look at someone moved, just like that little picture, right. Where I watch basketball and I figure out, okay, how do I make this happen? And I literally taught myself the game, how to run, jump, shoot, pass, do everything.
So you go to the University of Maryland.
Correct.
It's a big school in the ACC.
Yes.
It has a real good basketball reputation.
Yes.
And you try out for the team. Walk on. You're a walk on. No scholarship.
Well, actually, what happened was I wanted to play college basketball so incredibly badly. It was the only thing I ever dreamt of, right? But like I said, growing up the way I did, that was not something that you would do. So I ended up going to the University of Maryland. And then my first year, I heard about a tryout. And I thought, let me give this a try. So what ended up happening was I tried out, and there were about 100 kids, guys standing there. All
now, the coach was a guy named Bob Wade.
Correct.
Who was a marvelous coach at Dunbar High School in Baltimore, Maryland.
Correct.
How do I know all this?
Yeah, because you're a local and you love the sports. Yes.
And so Bob Wade makes this big transition to the University of Maryland.
Correct. So what happened was there were 100 guys there, and then we started doing drills and playing. And then it was cut from 100 to 90 to 80 to 70, 60. I'm still standing there. 50, 40, 30, 20. And now there's 10, me included. And I'm looking around going, oh, my God, what's going on? And we started playing pickup, and I was playing great. I could shoot, pass, dribble. I could do everything. And then they had to winnow it down to, I think there were 4 walk-ons that year or 5. And I remember getting a tap on my shoulder, and it was an assistant coach. And he pulled me aside and he goes, you know, we had you, where'd you come from? And I said, well, I went to a Jewish school down the road. And like, we never would have expected this set. We had no idea who you were. And he's like, well, we've already committed to 5 walk-on spots this year. Would you like to be the manager? And I was literally crushed because it was the only thing that I ever wanted in my entire life was to play college basketball. And I literally, like, I cried, like, real tears. And I, like, kind of held on to that love of basketball because I don't know why, there was nothing more important to me than basketball.
So later on, you kind of migrate to the West Coast. You go to law school.
Correct.
There, and you get your law degree.
Correct.
And you are a lawyer.
Correct.
And you're in a big firm.
Yes.
And you don't like it.
No. So I remember, you know, when you grow up religious like I do, you kind of tend to see everything in the form of prayer. So I remember sitting behind my big lawyer desk with my big lawyer suit, with my big lawyer pile of work, and I would just clasp my hands together and go, God, please get me out of here. I do not know what I'm going to do next. And I was kind of hoping that God would send down this big lightning bolt that would impale itself on my desk.
Don't tell me.
With an answer.
Don't tell me he gave you an answer.
Well,
it was close.
It was, but I never ever knew it was an answer until I looked back later on. So what I used to do was before work, because I would get very, very anxious and frustrated before I had to go to work every morning, I would literally self-medicate myself by swimming as long as I could and running as fast as I could. I would spend like an hour in a pool and a half an hour on the treadmill, and I would exhaust myself so I could come back to work feeling calm before I started. And as I was leaving the gym one day, I saw a cork board with an ad for a 12-year-old boys basketball team. And I thought, maybe this will let me get out of the office for a couple of hours a week and give some normalcy to my life. So I volunteered to coach this team, but I had low billable hours, so the senior partners wouldn't even let me leave the office. Right. So I had to convince them this was for business development. So then I went out of my own pocket and I paid to get jerseys made with the logo of the firm stenciled on the back so that I could say I'm trying to, you know, create business for the firm. And they were like, okay, fine, no problem. And I literally gave the kids drills that I had created for myself when I was a kid, shooting drills, dribbling drills, conditioning drills. And after a couple of weeks, a parent said to me, what are you doing with my kid? My kid is hyper. My kid is a spaz. My kid is difficult. I've never seen my kid so engaged in anything in my entire life. What are you doing? I said, well, I don't know. Maybe I know more than the dad who's coaching his own kid's team. So meanwhile, I'm still working at this law firm, still miserable, right? And there was a senior partner there that always kept me on edge. If he walked by the office and said, Edan, what time is it? I'd have to say, you mean London time, Singapore time, or New York time? Like every question he asked me, I was rattled. And then one day, like, he called me into his office and he started raising his voice at me. And I was like, you know what? I am done with this. And I went into my office, typed up a letter of resignation, and I quit. Now, mind you, I had no idea what I was going to do next with my life. I move home. I'm sending, like, resumes out. No one's giving me a bite.
So you go back
to
the Washington area.
Correct. And I literally living with my parents again. And I'm thinking, what am I doing with my life right now? Because I felt like a big old loser. I was like, how is this happening? And so I did what I always knew I had to do. I'd go to the park and play to kind of like calm my thoughts down.
So you're playing playground ball.
Playground ball again. And I go to the park and I end up running into a couple kids that were I used to play with successfully. Now they were bigger, taller, faster, stronger. And now they were playing ball overseas. And I don't know what made me say this to them, but I said, hey, you guys want to go to the gym and work on a few things? And they said, sure. And never in a million universes did I know that that conversation would lead me years later to this unbelievable world I'm in now.
So we're going to get down
to
exactly your view of how to train.
Sure.
But the first big person you trained,
yes,
because he was getting ready for the draft,
sure,
was an All-American basketball player from Maryland, Steve Francis.
Correct.
Who became a great NBA star.
Correct.
And he became kind of, for you, the word of mouth.
Correct. But it's interesting because I always found in the NBA circles, it's like when, you know, I don't have kids, but like my sisters, and they'll always tell me, when you find a nanny or you find a good babysitter, you don't share because it's so hard to find, right? So at the end of the day, the NBA guys, like, you would make a dent in their career, but they would not like to talk about it because they wouldn't want to share their secret sauce. Correct. So it was like, it wasn't the word of mouth that's as easy as people think. It took a lot of like—
But Francis said something.
Well, yes. And also the thing, it was also allowed me to kind of use Steve as sort of an element of credibility. But when I started working with NBA guys, I'd always say, I was a zero-star chef. I had a very good palate and I had very good intuition, but I didn't really like understand like all the nuance that goes into being what I do today, right? And so with Steve, if I look back, I was pretty janky, right? But
so
I,
raw. You were raw.
But again, I had good intuition. Like I understood what I wanted to achieve, and I had like a good sense. Like there was no one ever going to bully me in the gym, right? Like I'm pretty soft-spoken guy. I don't raise my voice. I don't curse. But like even Kobe's not going to back me down, right? And I think players got that very quickly. That I know I believe in my gospel. But my gospel has kind of changed over time. It's become much more refined.
There's a quote from Steph, and you were working with him as he was preparing for the draft.
Correct.
That he never had worked in a way before that he worked with you.
Yes, and I think that it's an element of, like, when people say, did law help your career, hurt your career? And I think what law did was socialize you to a work ethic. Because it's something where I had no problem putting 100-hour work weeks. I was always a very hard worker, even like in sports or anything in my life. So I think when I would see what athletes were doing, I thought, my gosh, you're not really doing much, right? Or there's not a lot of focus in it. So I found that if you give me 10 minutes with 100% focus, it's almost like you gave me 6 hours. And so what I learned to do was just teach them how to kind of really focus their energy and their time and give them stuff they had never seen before. Because when you haven't seen something, your focus is a little bit different than when you have seen it. And because I wasn't privy to these palace doors that everyone else did in the NBA world, right, I had to kind of come up with my own methodology and my own philosophy and my own gospel.
So let's talk about that, yeah. All right? Strange. You're a trainer.
Yeah.
You train. Okay, guys, we're going to train 1 hour.
Yeah.
Just an hour. That's it.
The thing is that I never framed the session that way. I just knew, like, I just had in my mind what I wanted to accomplish. Like, I've worked with over 100 NBA players and 15 NBA All-Stars and dozens of WNBA All-Stars. I've never walked in with a piece of paper. I never walked in with an outline.
But just tell me why an hour seemed right for you.
Because I know how hard it is. Right? I think when I had a chance to work with Kobe, like, he sort of framed exactly what I was trying to do. Which was, it wasn't that Kobe worked so hard. It was the mental intensity and stamina that he kept. It was like almost like every day he treated like it was finals week. And when people, like, finals week in college or grad school, it's a monster, right? It's the intensity that you have to have. And it's something that I saw of him very quickly. And the goal for me was to, every time I'd be in a gym with an athlete, to make them feel like it's finals week, to be very, very, very serious in this endeavor.
So I'm trying to get – how long, for instance, did you work with Kobe?
I probably spent –
How many times?
I probably spent less than a week with him.
That's it?
Yes.
And
yes.
How about LeBron?
Probably, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks with him.
Now, yeah. As I understand it with LeBron,
yeah,
it was interesting because you had to you kept tapping him on his chin.
Correct.
Why?
So – Life of Pi is like one of my favorite books of all time, right? And there's something about when you're on the life raft with a bunch of, like, you know, with the lion, the bear, and these very, very ferocious animals, and not the players are animals, but just metaphorically, that you can't be meek and timid, or otherwise, like, the message will never be conveyed. And so when LeBron would put his head down, I would intentionally smack
his
chin.
You mean dribble and with his head down?
Yes. And it's
like, well, wouldn't most people do? That's where the ball is.
Well, at this level, though, they are the Rolls Royce of basketball. Right. So seeing something like that was like, this is unacceptable.
They could do it with their eyes closed.
Correct. So I made it a point to slap his chin. And it wasn't because I'm not an aggressive person, but it was more to send the message of, like, in this room, like, you know, this is the life of Pi on this boat. Like, we have to be very, very clear that I'm not backing down. You're not backing down. We have, like, there's a goal we have to meet, and we're going to be very aggressive and serious about this.
So with his head up,
yes,
he's sending a message.
I'm sending him a message, which was very important, which was, like, details matter.
And then he's sending a message to the opponents.
Correct.
About, right, Don't screw around with me.
Correct.
I got my head in your eyes.
Right. And the thing to me is the message of, like, details matter, right? Even if you're, you know, it's like, when I see people diet, it's very easy to diet out in public. It's another thing to eat, to diet at home, right? When you can easily cheat, you can pick out some things from the cupboard, right? The point is that even in a small gym with us alone, the details matter. I'm watching you. Keep your head up. Don't cheat.
Why would you throw tennis balls at your trainees?
Okay, so years ago, I was in a commercial with Carmelo Anthony for Nike. And part of the commercial, they wanted to sort of get an inside scoop on how Melo trains. And one of the drills there's tossing a tennis ball as he's dribbling a basketball. And the producers had walked over to me and said, oh, that's for eye-hand coordination. And my response was no. These guys are so sophisticated. Eye-hand coordination was developed when they were 7 years of age. They're so far beyond that. They're like, why are you doing this? And my response was to create sensory overload.
What's that mean?
So when in an NBA game, there's so many distractions. There are cheerleaders on the sideline. There are photographers over here. There's defenders. Correct. So to me, it's like by creating that tennis ball, I've created an immense distraction to your nervous system so that handling the ball becomes an easy thing when I remove the tennis ball. So in a basketball game, you have your teammates screaming for the ball. You have defenders trying to reach the ball. You have a coach calling for plays. You have fans heckling you. There's so many things going on, right? So the idea is try to replicate that. And I found like I could do that with a tennis ball because it would kind of consume your nervous system because you'd be thinking about that instead of the ball. And that was the intention of that drill.
So I'm sure there are some NBA coaches who are very grateful for what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And there are NBA coaches who said, why do I need this guy?
Sure.
I mean, I know a coach.
Yeah.
I have a coach acquaintance.
Yeah.
Who didn't really like you.
I'm sure.
Larry Brown.
Sure. Yes.
Why?
Well, I think that there is an assumption that if you wore a jersey, you have a monopoly on wisdom. And I found that I would see that a lot in professional basketball. It's because I played at North Carolina, or I'm related to David Stern, or all that. This idea that how could you possibly know something that I don't? You know, the head of Sony Music's not a former guitar player, right? The head of Mercedes-Benz isn't a former race car driver, right? It's like you don't always have to be one to do something, right? So I think the idea—
I know football coaches who never played—
Correct.
You know, outside of, you know— Double A3.
Correct. And so that's why I felt that pushback all the time, and my response would be the gym is closed because I was not interested in anyone's feedback. I knew what I wanted to get done. I needed the transparency of my athlete, and I needed them to understand I'm not in charge.
So they wouldn't know what you were doing?
No, and I didn't, and I never— No.
Because you closed the gym.
I closed the gym, always, yes. And there was no social media. There was no girlfriends. There was no cell. It was literally, I treated the, like, it was like—
Yeah, but Carmelo Anthony's wife said something to you.
But it was interesting because when I met Lala years ago, I think she was trying, and I understand because I don't look the part, right? So I understand there was like a vetting mechanism.
First of all, you know, you're kind of my height. I mean,
sure. And I don't have big muscles, and I don't have the University of North Carolina jersey on my back, and I don't come from the institution of sports.
So she wanted to check you out.
Correct. Right. And I understood that, and I was patient with that, and I didn't mind it, right? Because I think it came from a good place.
And what did she say?
I think it was like she asked me to show her how to shoot, right? And I did. And I think she walked away going, okay, he knows what he's talking about, right? And the reality is like, I know a lot what I'm talking about, right? But it was okay. The skepticism is okay, I think, if it comes from a good place, right? But I often found that in part of the institution of sports that there was this reluctance to be able to accept anyone's outside opinion. It's like, how could you possibly know about shooting if you've never shot a ball in the NBA? And my response is, because that's not the scope of my work. The scope of my work is not asking me to shoot a three. The scope of my work is making sure that you're the best three-point shooter. And that's what I can do. So—
You don't teach anybody how to shoot.
I've taught many people how to shoot.
Really?
Many. But not in a way that we think, right? Because I think it's—
You didn't teach Steph that three-pointer, did you?
No, but shooting to me there's a very narrow perspective on shooting, and there's a very broad definition of shooting. To me, shooting is not just the release of the ball. To me, there's all the elements that happen before you do that and all the elements that happen after you do that, right? So throwing a football is just not the mechanic of just letting the ball flick off your wrist. There is how you come back in the pocket, how you plant your hips. There's so many pieces that before and after that lead up to it. So in that element, I feel like every athlete I've worked with them on their shot. you know, there was one athlete I remember working with, Andre Drummond, who played at the Detroit Pistons for him. And he literally was the career worst free throw shooter in NBA history.
Yeah, he was.
At like maybe 28%. And the Pistons brought in every expert you can imagine. The chemist, the physicist, the VR person, the AI person, the meditative guy, the Dalai Lama, Jerry West. Everyone you can imagine was coming in to try to fix Andre Drummond's jump shot. And even Stan Van Gundy had almost got to the idea of like just shoot one-handed or underhanded, right? And I remember Andre calling me. He's like, hey, man, can we connect this summer? I said, sure. And I want to say in less than 4 weeks, 5 weeks, he went from a 28% free throw shooter to an 80% free throw shooter.
Really?
And the idea was, and we never shot free throws. So
you never shot?
No, because I think there's so
What'd
many-
What'd you do?
Everything else. So a lot of times, I think I learned that you can address a problem by not necessarily addressing the problem, right? So there's ways of like helping people without necessarily trying to go to the bullseye. Because I think sometimes you go to the bullseye, you magnify the problem.
Okay. All right.
Right?
So quickly.
Yes.
If you're not messing with the shot.
Well, we did shoot, right? We did shoot a lot, and we did lots of other things. But we didn't sit at the free throw line for 7 hours trying to shoot a free throw. And I think that that's part of where I think I'm successful, is that I can solve a problem in ways other people don't see the answer. I can find many keys to the lock where other people are just looking for one key, right? And so, for example, if every day I see you at work and I say, Maury, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? After the third week, you're going to start wondering, am I okay?
Right.
Right? And that's what happens a lot in professional sports, right? Stats and coaches and people always in your face about, why can't you shoot free throws? Well, the reality is you've now convinced me I can't shoot free throws. It doesn't mean that like you're not allowed to like ask those questions, but it magnifies the problem. And the key is sometimes to unravel it mentally, physically, emotionally.
I think we as fans don't realize the mental aspect of preparation.
Oh, it's huge. And I think, I mean, the one thing that I give professional athletes is that many levels, what LeBron James has done is beyond remarkable. I can't only have the words to explain it. It's one thing to get to the top. It's the other thing to stay at the top.
At 40 plus.
Correct. And do this for 22 years. And remember, NBA teams are pretty sophisticated. They're looking at every weakness, every strength. There's like schemes to stop you. And every day he brings it. Every day he like does it at the highest level. It's beyond comprehension what he has done. But he makes it look so easy. We just go, oh, that's just LeBron James. But the mental strength.
I saw incredible. A documentary with all the stuff he goes through.
Yes, yes.
In terms of, you know, trainers and people working on his body.
Yes. And the thing is, it's like
every day.
Right. And there's the physical preparation, but it's also being so immersed in that it translates into the performance. It's one thing to sort of jump rope and go, okay, I feel light for the game. It's another thing to jump rope and understand that movement will translate into performance, right?
Now, are you today training people or not?
I do, but I tapered it down some.
So, well, I know one of the reasons why.
Yeah.
Because you got infatuated in another aspect of this business, and that is anybody who watched Winning Time on HBO,
yeah.
Those two seasons, mm-hmm. That was the magical run of the Los Angeles Lakers,
right?
From nobodies to somebodies. Mm-hmm. You coached all those actors in that show.
Yeah, and what happened was I got a phone call from the producers in HBO asking me if I would have interest in helping on this show. And at first I was like, well, what does this mean? And then I ended up meeting with Adam McKay, who's like a legendary director, executive producer. And the first question was, can you turn one of our actors into Magic Johnson? And I laughed. I said, there's 400 guys in the NBA who can't be Magic Johnson. But if anyone on this planet who can do this, I can. But I said, I need to sort of see what this will involve. And they said, well, do you have a week to do this? I said, a week? That's like turning Bruce Lee into a black belt overnight. Impossible.
You worked for months.
Years. Yes.
So you took this kid.
Yes.
Who was a football player.
He was a 6'3", 285-pound lineman. Right. And then, so I ended up doing this across all the characters and then plus all the other creative elements to it.
Yeah, I mean, so, you did Kareem, you did Magic, you did
Nixon,
Michael Cooper,
Larry Bird, Dr. J, everybody. So the thing that I remember, I was doing some interviews with HBO and they were asking me about this process. And I said, the first part of this process was you had to turn them into an athlete because a lot of them were not, right? And that also included making them more athletic. They had to lose a ton of weight. The next phase of this process was turning them into a basketball player because most weren't. Because oftentimes on set, what's required is a lot of improvisation. So if you only know how to do one kata in a black in a Bruce Lee movie, you're stuck, right? Because at any moment, a director will say, well, we need something else. And if the athlete can't do something else, then you can't film. So the first phase was athlete. Second phase was basketball players. Third phase was silhouette. And the silhouette means meaning finding every single nuance of that of Larry Bird. How does he walk, move, shoot, spit, everything that he would do on that court and the court. And you have to now and make that part of their game when they play.
And with Magic.
Magic was so dramatic, right? It's how he flared his fingers on a pass and he would smile and he would look away. Like there is, because film requires drama. It's just, we're not making a documentary. So it's in order to recreate this with the emotion, right, and the authenticity that the audience was expecting. So it's teaching all of them that element, right?
Did you ever talk to Magic?
No, I did not because I wasn't interested necessarily in their opinion. Not because I didn't respect their opinion, but I think—
But you don't know anything about what Magic thought about how this guy played him on the court.
And it's okay that I didn't because everyone is sort of entitled to their sort of perception of
it. Because, of course, you know that Jerry West hated the series.
Yes.
Kareem did not like the series.
Sure.
I don't think Magic had much of an opinion one way or another.
Look, and I don't blame them for feeling the way they do. It's okay. I think my only responsibility was to make sure that I could deliver on my responsibility, right? Which is, I know the game well enough, I know the camera well enough, I know filmmaking well enough to know I can turn you into Magic, right? The portrayal of the character was not up to me. That was up to, the studio.
Yeah.
But in terms of, delivering—
On the court, it was your business.
Correct.
And, I mean, I watched both seasons, and I thought you did a great job.
Yeah, it looked very real. Never once did anyone say, that doesn't look like them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought the Kareem kid was terrific.
It was terrific, yes.
And did you teach him a skyhook?
And the thing is that what people don't understand how complicated the skyhook was, it is a shot that is, it's slow, refined, and powerful at the same time. So it's incredibly counterintuitive physiologically to say, I'm going to move slow but powerful. Because in order to move powerful, you have to move fast. And that's why Kareem is such the unicorn, because there was this, you move slowly in the approach, and then all of a sudden you explode at the end. It's like it doesn't work like that. Like the Ferrari has to glide into 60 miles an hour. It just doesn't, right? It takes time, and that's what took so long to be able to master those iconic moments on that show.
So you got, did you fall in love with? Hollywood?
I've always said that I think training.
I tell you, it can be some.
Yes, I love the idea of filmmaking and creating, and so I had written books, and that led me to writing features and to being more involved in Hollywood. Yes, and I think the one thing that I have always sort of done in training,
that's what it is.
Yeah, it's like I always know when there's a good training session when it tells a story. There's a beginning, middle, and end. Right. Every training session I've ever had with an athlete has an arc to it. Something I want to achieve. Right. There is like I said, beginning, middle, and end. Right. So in professional sports, I'm worried about, does the ball go in? Is there efficiency? Is there speed? Is there movement? Like, different metric. In film, I'm still looking at performance, but I'm going, is this authentic? Is this credible? Is this beautiful? Is this cinematic?
Especially when it comes to sports.
Correct.
Sports, I mean, more than anything else.
Yes.
I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That kid can't play.
Correct. Right. And so you have to be able to hit those same different metrics, but still under the umbrella of performance. And I know performance extraordinarily well. To me, I was just now creating a different system of identifying that, but still falling under that same rubric.
I want to talk about the WNBA for a second. Different?
No.
Your attitude different?
No.
Your methods different?
No. If anything, I found such admiration for the WNBA because they play with a different sense of purpose. Because the economics are so different. Oh. So there's a purity in the intention, which I loved, right? This was not about like getting the $7 million Gatorade deal. This was like, I love to play. I will play hard. And I've worked with some unbelievable, I won't even say like players, people. Like Kara Lawson, who kind of coaches at Duke, is an extraordinary human being. Maya Moore is an extraordinary human being. Skylar Diggins, Tina Charles. Like I worked with some like Hall of Fame WNBA players and also extraordinary people. And they didn't play the game for the money or the accolade. They played truly because they love basketball.
You seem to have a surety about yourself in terms of, and some people would say maybe too much.
Well, but I think it's something that's earned over time, right? Like I'm self-made, right? So over time I became much more educated and much more experienced and all that stuff. But if I didn't believe in myself, who would?
Have you ever thought about what you feel about basketball can be transferred to other sports or not?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with tennis players. I've worked with golfers. I've worked with C-level executives.
What did you do with golfers?
So I don't know the mechanics of golf, right?
Yeah.
But what I do know is
I do.
Right. But what I do know is I know how to question stuff that doesn't make sense to me, and I do understand biomechanics.
Like, what's that mean?
So, for example, I didn't understand in golf why so much time is put in such a sedentary position, because all it does is allows the mind to wander. Right?
Wow.
So oftentimes when I would work with a golfer, I wouldn't let them settle their feet into the ground, right? I would make them pedal their feet a little bit, right? Because sort of that pedaling their feet is no different than doing a ball handling drill. It is sort of like it lets you warm up your system, because it's hard to go from, it's like basic physics. It's hard, like a force that's moving is a faster force than one that's not moving. So if I want to swing a golf ball, I want to hit it 300 yards, I want my feet to pedal a little bit so I get some rhythm into my swing, right? That was like one thing. I also, when I worked with golfers, I work a lot on their like on developing more power, right? So we lift a lot, we run a lot, we move a lot, we sprint a lot, right? Because it's that fast switch that's allowing to propel the ball much farther, right? So there was a lot of like philosophy I knew from athletic and sports performance I would apply to golf. I also think too that too much time is spent thinking in golf, right?
That's true.
And I think that creates the natural yips.
It's like a friend of mine. I asked a friend of mine who's a decent golfer. I used to say, Scotty, how many thoughts do you have over the ball? He says, well, I've got this one forward swing thought. I have that thought. So he says to me, how many thoughts do you have? I said, well, I'm trying to pare it down from 11.
Correct. But now imagine if I said to you, you only have 1 second to shoot.
Right.
It would change. But for some reason, there's this idea that you have to sit still for a long time, aim. And I'm thinking, all that could be done prior to hitting the golf ball.
Yeah.
Right?
It's interesting how the relationships between coach and player are remarkable, because there's a part of your life in which these guys were very arrogant.
Right.
These players.
Sure.
Some didn't pay you.
Right.
They wanted you there all the time.
Correct.
They wanted your time to be their time.
Correct.
And then they wouldn't even pay you.
Correct.
I have a golf coach.
Mm-hmm.
He coached some of the best players on the professional golf tour forever.
Right.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same experiences.
Yes.
They don't pay you.
Right.
But they expect that they own you.
Correct. And so I always tried to frame what return on investment means to me, right? Return on investment was not always a monetary thing. It was something that gave me a lot of joy. So I always looked at training, not as it, obviously I have to pay my rent, right? But whenever I got paid, I was always surprised.
And from, yeah, who was the first guy who ended up, I remember.
Elton Brand was the first player that paid me.
Yeah.
And for many years, I would
Elton
not.
Elton Brand was a great player from Duke.
And a great human being. And I remember for many, many years, when people ask me, what do I charge? I would tell them, pay me whatever you think I'm worth to you. Because I didn't know what my value was. And for many, many years, in order to appease my parents, whatever I got, I'd let my mom deposit in my account so she knew that this former lawyer could still survive,
right?
Because I think the Jewish mother needed some assurance that her kid was alive and doing okay.
My mother had problems there.
you understand, right? Especially when you pursue a non-conventional profession.
Sure.
And were there many moments I didn't get paid? Of course. But also many businesses don't collect on their accounts receivable, and I understand that. But I always thought
where did this self a feeling of entitlement with these guys come from?
Look,
is it because of their, the fact that they were the BMOC, the big man on campus?
Yes.
I mean, is it?
Well, I think a lot of it, they have different rules to play by, right? And I think the fact that I think we're also co-conspirators in this, in their development, right? Because we ask for their autographs, we put them on TV, we give them so much love and praise and accolades since they were little kids that they kind of did have a different perspective on what's right and wrong. And I'm not saying that there's always a couple apples that don't do what they're supposed to, but there's many apples that do, right? So I've had a couple experiences with apples that didn't honor their word, and that's okay. But I knew what I was getting into when I did this dance, right? Like this.
So you knew there would be.
Of course.
Those who would say.
Of course.
Who would just use you.
Of course. Okay. But I also know, too, that I loved doing the work. And even if someone didn't pay me, it would be the last time I ever work with you, right? But I still found joy in that moment, right? Because I didn't equate my time with my money.
I think my golf teacher feels the same way.
Right. Like I truly think that's why there was no social media for me. I don't post
them. I guarantee you that I've paid my golf teacher much more money than any of the pros
he worked with. I'm sure.
You got paid for the winning time seasons.
Correct.
I mean, I'll tell you a story about turning somebody into an athlete.
Yeah.
My father told me this story.
Yeah.
My father was a sports columnist of the Washington Post for 75 years.
Yes.
Okay. So he says that when Gary Cooper played Lou Gehrig in the Lou Gehrig story.
Yep.
He was a right-hander, and Gehrig was a left and batted left-handed. They reversed the film to shoot the movie.
Interesting.
They had to reverse the film.
And I had a situation on Winning Time where
you had a left-hander, right-hander.
They cast Michael Cooper was left-handed, and we spent 2 years turning him into a right-handed player.
Wow!
Because I was so sensitive to that, and over the pandemic, we would meet virtually and literally hours and hours and hours developing a right hand that was non-existent. So I completely relate with that, but I was meant to make sure that the audience didn't go, wait a minute, something's wrong here. So I totally understand.
Did you ever talk to Cooper?
I didn't talk to any of them.
None?
Right? No, because there was a part of me that wanted to say, I got this. Like these are my childhood idols. I would never do anything to jeopardize how I perceive them. Like I love Magic and Kareem and Knicks. I truly do that. I adore them. So in my heart, I would never do anything that didn't reflect them at the highest level. But I didn't need their input in how I made the cake.
Magic loves my wife. My wife, Connie Chung, used to work in Los Angeles for the local station when Magic was playing, and Magic loved her.
Yeah.
Used to take her to the chicken and waffle place.
Oh, Roscoe's. Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's funny.
And Roscoe's, right. And she was able to get the exclusive interview when Magic tested for HIV.
Wow.
And she even has a basketball with Magic saying how much she loves her. He is a terrific guy.
He's done, he's changed the world in many ways.
Yeah.
Yes. You know?
I played high school sports.
Mm-hmm.
Back then in the 50s, it was baseball, basketball, football. That's what you played.
Right.
And I was a 6'1 center on the Landon School basketball team in the Washington area. We used to scrimmage, okay? It goes so far back that the great high school basketball coach, Morgan Wooten,
of course,
reffed our games before he was ever a coach.
Wow.
And I remember I had to scrimmage against this young kid named John Thompson.
Wow.
Who was the opposing center at 6'10.
Wow. Did you feel a pressure to play sports because of your pop?
No, I love sports.
You did.
I went to the. It's very simple. I went to the Landon School.
Yes.
Because they were playing hardball and baseball, and everybody else was playing softball.
Interesting.
I mean, I just wanted to compete, and I ended up honorable mention all private in basketball yeah. and stuff. And I played with guys on an all prep, all private, all Catholic, big time game at the end of the season. With Doug Moe,
oh, wow.
who ended up at the University of North Carolina, and then, All-American, and a coach
Denver.
At Denver.
Yep.
Joe Bellino ended up winning the Heisman Trophy at Navy.
Yep.
And it was great. But I knew as soon as I went to the University of Pennsylvania as a freshman, my days as a 6'1 center were over. And they tried on the freshman team to turn me into a guard.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, I had no chance.
When did you discover that you love journalism?
I always was going to love it because I kind of grew up at my father's knee and went to all the games with him and watched him. And I wanted to be a writer.
Right.
But in Washington, D.C., the only papers were the Washington Post, which my father was, and I couldn't go there because there was a nepotism policy.
Yep.
And the Washington Star wasn't going to hire me because I was a Povich, and that would not look right.
So the question I have for you isn't something I saw in the NBA world. Steph Curry becoming an NBA player in some ways is not a surprise to me because since he was 2 years old, he had an NBA-sized ball in his hand, and he'd watch this. And when he came to the NBA
and
world—
And with Dell.
Yes, and I think like one of the things that I would remember teams would asking me, I'd say, he's going to be revolutionary. And part of it is that nothing will surprise him because he's seen the lifestyle. He's seen the cars and the money and the girls. He's lived this. It's his DNA. It's what he knows, right? But I also wondered, like, what would Steph be if he didn't come in— grew up in a family like this. And I also wondered to you, would you have still been a journalist had you not grown up in a world of journalism?
You know, it's an interesting question. I've never been asked it. And I have no idea. I mean, I was an absolute flunky in college. I flunked out 1 year. I mean, I could care less about school. I'll tell you, I don't remember learning anything in school except the social relationships that I got out of it. So therefore, I was an English literature major.
But I think when you're very, very bright, so when you flunk out, that's an intentional decision. That's not a negligence.
You think so?
Yes.
Yeah, so well, I'll tell you why I flunked out. I didn't go to class.
But you still maintained that love of the pen and the love of story.
Yeah.
So even though you've rejected traditional academics, you still managed
and
to
love.
And
by that time, I was starting to work
at
the age of 16 in the summertime with the Washington Senator baseball team.
Right.
So I was around writers all the time. I was around these athletes.
Right.
And I knew that I wanted to go, if I couldn't go into print journalism, television. My father used to say to me, he says, so what's your job? And by the way, I'm getting coffee, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm carrying equipment. I said, I'm an associate producer. He says, son, I see what you do.
Right.
You're in the right business if you think you're an associate producer with what you do.
But how did you maintain? So I have to imagine someone said to you, son, if you want to be a real journalist, you got to like pick those grades back up. Was there ever kind of an ultimatum, which is?
It was a devastating ride back from the University of Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C., from Philadelphia to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
My father came to get me.
Yeah.
He was so embarrassed, and I felt so embarrassed that I said to myself, I can't...
This will never happen again.
I can't let this happen.
And then how did you rejuvenate the academics and the life?
I said to my father at the time, now this is during, I think it was like 1960 and people were getting drafted. And so I was going to go into the service for 6 months. And my father says, you're not going into the service now. Let me tell you what you're going to do.
Right.
I'm going to call up my friends at American University, mm-hmm. and you're going to get into that school,
right.
and you're going to work hard
right.
so that the University of Pennsylvania will take you back in a year.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened.
And then?
I went back to Penn, graduated after 5 years in a summer.
And then what happened with the journalism passion?
Immediately went. It's an interesting thing. So therefore, I had worked at the college radio station.
Yep.
I wanted to go into sports broadcasting.
Right.
That's what I wanted to do.
Right.
So now, and I'm getting married a month after college.
Right.
And I got to get a job.
Right.
And I want to go into broadcasting. And the only, right. back then, the only way you could get into television, mm-hmm. everybody who was in television in 1962
right.
was in radio first.
Okay.
You couldn't get into television without being in radio.
Right.
So I went to a radio station, mm-hmm. and I said, well, what's your experience? I said, what do you mean, what's my experience? I have no experience.
Right.
So if you have no experience, you want to get there, you have no experience, how do you think, we're not going to give you a job.
Right.
We have all these guys who are experienced.
Right.
So I ended up being an assistant publicity writer.
Interesting.
Hanging around the newsroom.
Right.
After a year, they got so mad at me. Hanging around the newsroom, they gave me a job as a reporter. And that's how it started. Because I was so fascinated with news. I don't know, so fascinated with sports.
Did you feel like you wanted to follow in your father's footsteps, or you wanted to sort of create
I just wanted to make my own name.
Your own name.
Right. I wanted to make my own name.
Yes.
Knowing
right.
that I was in a town
right.
where my father's name was gold.
So did you read less of his stuff, watch less of his stuff, so that you would never become derivative of his stuff?
No. But what I did do yeah. after 10 very successful years,
right.
I said, I got to go find out if this will travel.
Got it.
And I had a seven-year odyssey working for four different stations,
yep.
five different stations in 7 years. And I came back to Washington
yeah.
where everything happened.
And what's that moment where you said, I made it?
Maybe tomorrow.
Huh.
I've never...
What's the moment where you pinch yourself and go, I can't believe this?
I don't. Never did.
It's beautiful.
Never did. Never. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never in my life felt that I was better than the guy in the bar that I was talking to.
But not from a judgment point of view, but almost like, I can't believe that everything that I dreamt about is here.
Well, I said before on a podcast, I think you have to fail.
Yes.
In order to make it. You got to fail. I was so upset at myself
right.
for misknowing.
Right.
What this fear was.
Right.
Because if I knew that the fear really came from my feelings,
right.
I wouldn't have given a shit.
Were you devastated?
Yeah, at the time. Because then I was going through a divorce at the same time.
Right.
So I had to tell my parents that I was being fired from
yep.
the job because it was going to be in the newspaper in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I was getting divorced, and I hadn't told my parents yet. And I hesitated so much, so I called up my father.
Yeah.
And I said, I have some terrible news to tell you.
Yeah.
I said, I just was fired from my job,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also getting a divorce,
mm-hmm.
and because the marriage isn't working. And he had this long pause, and I thought I was going to just. He says, take all these sharp instruments out of the house and come home and give your mother a hug. I never expected that from my
right.
kind of a tough father.
Right.
You know, he's a Jewish guy, too.
Of course.
You know.
But I think it's because he recognized that you earned that disappointment because you were so devoted for so long. Right. And sometimes shit happens. Right. And sometimes shit happens kind of out of our control a little bit. Right. I don't think people lose jobs because they're not good. I think sometimes people lose jobs because of circumstance. There's a boss that doesn't appreciate you. There's lots of reasons. And I bet at that moment there was a lot of compassion.
There was.
Because your father had seen all that.
Which, you know, I don't think he ever hugged me in his life.
Right.
I can't remember five times he said, I love you. I mean,
right.
He's, you know, he was that kind of a dad.
Yeah.
You knew he did.
Right.
I was shocked. But obviously, he knew a lot more than I thought.
Do you like working for someone else, or do you like being your own boss?
I liked working for other people for a while.
Right.
But then, you know, I had, you know, management and I didn't get along a lot. For instance, when anchoring a news show for a half-hour news show,
right,
as an anchor,
right,
you're the big shot, right?
Yeah.
You're sitting there, you're reading 30 seconds into
sure.
a story that lasts a minute, and then you're saying, "There's more to that story than that."
Right?
What the hell am I doing? I'm just an automaton here, and so I would start ad-libbing the intros,
right.
Not looking at the prompter and doing my own. And the news director would go, what the shit are you doing? What are you? I said, well, I thought we needed a little more elaboration here.
Right.
We need to elaborate more. We had to give it more. We had to give it more punch. We had to give it more feeling. No, just read the prompter.
Right.
Well, that ended. That ended my anchoring after about 20 years or so. And then the fact I did this show, A Current Affair, which was great because I had a lot of latitude, and then the talk, I can do anything I want.
Yes.
I can handle it any way I want to.
Yes.
I can delve into stories.
Right.
I can be a storyteller, not a guy reading 30 seconds on a prompt.
Right. Which is interesting because sometimes I think those failures are our breadcrumbs to like more what we're meant to do in our life.
Oh, I agree
with
that.
I think it's a foreshadowing of like a gift.
I mean, I don't know what you think about it, but I believe fate played a huge role in my life.
Right.
It had to do with marrying my wife. It
yes.
had to, I mean, I was never a star, ever, until I married my wife.
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
She was the star.
Right.
I wasn't the star.
Right. But you were prepared for that moment?
Yeah.
Because of all those years of, like,
exactly.
effort. Correct. So I don't think, I believe in serendipity, but I don't believe in luck. Right? And so to me,
no, I don't think it's luck.
Right.
But
fate.
I think it's fate.
Correct.
Things happen.
Correct. Yes.
And I think, I really do believe, I mean, I think you fail up.
Yeah. And like I've always said, I grew up pretty religious, so you kind of tend to see things in terms of sometimes we lose a job or things happen because this guy kicking us off the couch and us not having the courage to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. So sometimes like me not succeeding at law was a blessing.
Right.
Right. And I think sometimes the goal is to be receptive to opportunity and the goal is to say yes much more than you say no. Right. And I think over time, I learned to live by the and principle, which is I can do this and versus the or.
Right.
Because when you work in corporate America, you're segregated to the or, which is I am a banker. That's it.
Right.
But being free and creative, you can say, well, I am a lawyer and I'm a trainer and I'm an artist and I'm an author and I'm the and principle.
It's like my wife says to me all the time. How come nobody knows all the things that you've done and all the interests that you have and the fact that you're a good writer and you can and you're a history buff and you're this and you're that. I said, look, as long as you know, who cares?
But I think the humility is part of your grace, right? And I think those are things that probably over the years people have been very attracted to. And that's why people are very vulnerable, transparent,
because there's gracefulness to this. There's no doubt
when
it came to my show, people came on the show because they wanted to unburden themselves and they felt safe in my presence.
Correct.
When I never, ever, ever experienced anything that they were going through.
So you raise a very interesting point. This is why there's something very symbiotic about our lives. I always say I grew up in a religious place, very like poor immigrant family. But what I saw in the world of sports, very different than my value system when I grew up with. But my response would be, I am in it, but not of it.
Right.
And when I would watch your show.
And that's okay.
Yes. And when I'd watch your show, I'd felt the same thing. You're in it, but not of it.
Right.
Right. And you're there to tell a story, to help people, but you don't have to live their life.
And I would tell them that.
Correct. Yes. And that's why it worked. Because you were almost like, you were the confession.
And the worst thing that pissed me off were all the critics who said, I was exploiting these people.
No.
I wasn't exploiting them. I was trying to find out answers.
Right.
I was trying to give them a sense that at least they knew what was happening and that they could deal with it or not deal with it afterwards.
And what you did was you democratized journalism because you gave everyone a voice.
Absolutely.
And nobody else did that. right? Because in the past, the only people you would hear were the famous people, right? But what made the show special is that everyone now had an opportunity to speak.
Yeah.
And that's unusual.
Politicians would come after me. I mean, everybody.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that's like, even though it became an institution and a tremendous success, I think people lost sight of the fact that this show gave people, like, there was an equality to people's voice.
You've written a lot for some very important publications,
haven't you?
Yeah.
Featured.
You've been in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Post.
Yes.
The New Yorker, Sports Illustrated, Forbes, Hollywood Reporter. I just want to give you a couple of quotes.
Sure.
Kevin Durant once said, "Idan has an almost spiritual approach to the game." Well, I guess we can figure that out after what we've talked about.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, there's a purity when you're pursuing something you love, right? That I think everyone has, whether you're a musician or a journalist, like a doctor. I think when you have the most purest intention and you do this because you love this, I think there's a spirituality associated with the work.
I think there's an overwhelmingly pure feature in basketball.
Correct. Yes.
If it's played.
Correct.
In a way that I remember that apparently is not being played that way anymore.
No, the game has changed dramatically. To me, the most beautiful part of the game is sort of this, like, this intersection of play and improvisation.
Right.
It's like this holy grail when you see it, is that you do enough to execute, and then when you see the opportunity, you become the artist, right? And I think that is when it's the most beautiful form of basketball. And I think these days it's much more on the improvisation side and very little on the play side. And I think that game has changed. I think it's influenced by media, social media, branding, where every athlete sort of feels that the more they do, the more they'll shine, instead of realizing that sometimes the less you do, the more you'll shine.
Yeah, it's almost like, I mean, there was a time when even Larry Bird would be more satisfied with the pass than he was the shot.
Correct. And I think, you know, you interview...
And Magic, too.
Of course, yes.
And even Jordan. Jordan had to learn, apparently. I saw a clip where it was later on where he was able to trust his playmates.
For sure. And look, I think if you interview in private 100 of 100 athletes and they talk about, you know, they all say they want to win. And the truth of the matter is, I think you want a bigger contract, which is okay because I understand that motivation, right? But the thing that sometimes is missing is that you can have both. You can win and you can have a big contract. Yeah. They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
And the one thing I unfortunately miss is are athletes staying with the same team the whole career.
Sure, sure.
I mean, for fans especially.
Correct. Yes.
It you know, you love a guy, and then all of a sudden, 4 years later, he's gone.
Right.
And just gone.
Right. Right.
And you only had that 4 years
Correct.
Of love.
And I think that's also built into the collective bargaining agreements, and that's built in. Like, there should be more of an emphasis on, I guess, the longevity with the team. But teams are also, you know, co-conspirators to this crime.
Sure.
Right? Because, you know, like, they don't do the right things to develop.
They could come through
right.
and sign the extension.
Sure.
They, you know.
They choose not to.
Yeah.
Right. But like,
because it was a money play for them.
If someone asked me, how do I improve upon the purity of basketball? I would say, and I love all the athletes, I want to do well, get rid of guaranteed contracts and let everything be bonus-based.
The Hoops Whisperer.
Yes.
That's the name of this book.
Correct.
So, give me a theme of it.
So, The Hoops Whisperer, I would say it's essentially the story of how, you know, relying on faith and intuition to help find your purpose in life. I learned very quickly what someone's priorities are. I can learn very quickly through a drill what they, you know, what they lack, what they don't. I kind of have X-ray vision. But in terms of getting to know them sort of interpersonally, I know that takes time, right? I try to walk in there without any sort of very clean.
Yeah, I can understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, because like...
By the way, that's what every journalist in the world should do.
Right.
You walk into every story clean.
Clean, yes.
No feelings.
Correct.
No biases.
Correct.
No thoughts.
Correct.
Just get the story.
And along the way, someone will give me hints that let me know a little bit more about them. Because oftentimes they're not the most transparent. So it's my responsibility to read between the lines.
Sure. I mean, you have people who are very...
Correct. Closed. You know. And that's okay, because I know over time they'll open up.
Hey, Don, we come to a part in the show where, mm-hmm. where we call it, I call it the 19th hole. It's an opportunity for you to ask me questions.
Right.
And I don't know the answer. I don't know the questions you're going to ask me, but you get a chance to find out something about me.
One sentence that describes your ethos.
My ethos?
Yeah. Oof. What do you live by? A code.
I'll tell you, and you'll know about this.
Yeah.
Because it comes from our religion.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
We don't know whether there's an afterlife or not.
Correct.
We don't know that.
Right.
But what we do know is, can we be written in the book of life?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's my ethos. I want to be written in the book of life.
And then how do you maintain that when you have so much around you? How do you stay so true to that core when there's resource and temptation and excess and all these things that are around you? Something I would have known different than being like around. You're the best of the best of the best. You're LeBron James of journalism. And so when you're at that level and you can pick and choose and have, how do you stay so aligned with that?
I just never clamored for it. I always thought of what I did is a job, mm-hmm. but it's the best job in the world.
Right. Right.
And that's mm-hmm. all I cared about was doing the job. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know where it was going to take me.
Right.
And I didn't really know how people would feel about it.
Right.
And even today, my wife says, you know, how you just let criticism wash right off you mm-hmm. is amazing. I said, you know, I just don't care. I just don't care. I know too many people who've absolutely burned out worrying about what people thought of them.
Sure. Sure.
And
that's where we're very similar in that respect. Because they're always going to be a critic.
Always.
And you can go pour on applause, right? So I learned that whether they pat you on the back or they not pat you on the back.
I'll tell you, I'm glad I lived. Mm-hmm. Although I really am glad I lived before social media in terms of my profession.
Yes.
I don't think I would have been able to read one comment about what people thought of me.
It's better. Yeah.
And yet, mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I have to, if I go on Instagram and my clips of my show come on, I look for the likes.
But it's okay.
That's all I care about are how many likes.
Yes.
I don't want to read it,
right?
But I care about how many likes there are.
And why do you think you care?
I have no idea.
Right. I think the reason you care about that is because you care about your audience. You care about the audience, and that's why they always cared about you.
Yeah, interesting. If you've had as much fun as I did, make sure you subscribe to On Par with Maury Povich on YouTube and tap that little bell so you don't miss a thing. And if you like to listen on the go, we're on Apple, Spotify, everywhere you get your podcast. Hit that follow button. I'll be back with more before you know it. On Par with Me, Maury Povich, is brought to you by Mopo Productions, A Better Life Media, and Radley Studios, with executive producers, me, Maury Povich, Holly J. Mirabella, and Christian Thompson. Supervising producer Mike Bournasian, and directed by Mark Leibowitz.